The hot weather broke this week, at least temporarily, but the dearth of good theatrical movie releases churned on. As Kurt Vonnegut would say, so it goes. Hi, I'm Dan Webster, host of Movies 101. And on this week's show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I are going to discuss one movie that played in theaters, the comedy Tammy, and two films we sought out on our respective on-demand services, The Congress and Hellion. So don't touch that dial, because a Seeking Out Good Cinema Wherever We Can Find It edition of Movies 101 is coming up next, right here on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.
Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga Law School.
And I'm Nathan Weinbinder, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and staff writer for the Spokesman Review.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that would go to the ends of the earth to, well, quite frankly, see what's there. But we would make, and in fact have made, similar efforts to see worthy film. And that's what we find ourselves doing more and more, ignoring what is offered in area theaters in favor of what we're able to see in the comfort of our own homes. This doesn't make us happy. But then again, after seeing the new release Tammy, not much about movie-going is apt to make any of the three of us happy at all. After that, virtually anything we saw on demand would have been an improvement, which makes us appreciate all the more the teen angst study Hellion and Ari Folman's wonderfully strange and bizarre The Congress. Let's begin, though, with the latest flick starring the talented comic actress Melissa McCarthy. Tammy was co-written by McCarthy and Ben Falcone, who is both the movie's director and McCarthy's husband. And it follows the movies, not to mention the sitcom Mike and Molly, that have made McCarthy a star. The best of those movies is Bridesmaids, the 2011 comedy that earned McCarthy an improbable but probably deserving Best Supporting Actress Oscar nomination. In that film, McCarthy plays Megan, a woman who, despite not having magazine cover looks at all, acts with a sexual energy that is as audaciously profane as it is simple and direct. As a statement that challenges our cultural idea of what constitutes beauty, it is brilliant. In her follow-up movies, McCarthy's characters have continued with the same shtick, but with less and less commentary. The result is Tammy, a film that offers what basically is a long string of fat jokes in search of a life lesson. I'll leave it to you, Nathan, both to give us a brief plot synopsis of Tammy and to take your best shots at what might be one of the stupidest movies of 2014.
I think saying a brief plot synopsis of Tammy might be redundant in several different ways, because there is barely a plot to this
Thelma
movie.
Thelma and Louise!
Well, and you have Susan Sarandon in this one echoing the road trip
role.
Trajectory of Thelma and Louise. What we have here is a road trip movie and sort of a mismatched buddy film as well. Tammy, played by Melissa McCarthy, within the first 5 minutes of this movie, crashes her car. She hits a deer, which then jumps back to life and pummels her in the face with her hooves, which is kind of like a brilliant metaphor for how this movie treats its audience. Then she loses her job at the fast food restaurant where she works. She comes home and finds out that her husband has been cheating on her with the woman next door.
The first five minutes,
this woman cannot win. So she decides to just escape life and drive off in her grandmother's car. She takes grandma with her, and that is Susan Sarandon. It's sort of depressing to think that Susan Sarandon has been relegated to playing grandmothers now, but that's Hollywood for you. She has a serious drinking problem as well, which sort of creates some drama in the second half of the film, which actually I think is the most effective stuff in Tammy. I think the comedy is completely worthless. I laughed maybe twice in the entire film. But there is some more serious material here that's sort of struggling to get out. The material involving the alcoholism. There are a couple characters here with some really serious drinking problems. And also the message of self-worth, which again, is not exactly revelatory, but it's kind of refreshing to see in a movie that has otherwise been advertised as the Melissa McCarthy Falls Down show. but otherwise, I mean, I think Tammy is a huge missed opportunity, especially because Melissa McCarthy wrote this role for herself, which is just absolutely baffling to me because there's nothing here for her to do that we haven't seen her do before and better. Also worse. I mean, I think Identity Thief from last year is even worse than Tamia's. But this is really a huge missed opportunity, both as a comedy and as a showcase for Melissa McCarthy, who is talented.
Absolutely, she's talented. And I agree that you would think if you were creating a product yourself or in conjunction with your spouse...
You put a little substance in there, maybe?
Right,
anything?
Right. And I think that there was some commentary, as you suggested, or alluded to the fact that there could have been, sort of in the background, because we have all these issues of sort of class and intergenerational conflict and marital infidelity. I don't know what Toni Collette was doing in this movie.
She had, three lines? Four lines?
And that's more than Sandra Oh did.
Right. Yeah. And so, it's this script does not go anywhere, even though it's a road movie. And so that's one of its ironies. Also, as we pointed out, I think Tammy has these random people show up. Kathy Bates, Dan mentioned Sandra Oh, Susan Sarandon. I mean, she is
Gary Cole shows up. And
Mark
his son
Duplass.
Is Mark Duplass, who becomes the requisite love interest.
Yeah, so there are these people sprinkled throughout, including Ben Falcone himself playing her boss. And she does get at least a couple of quips off directed toward him as the boss. And there were some physical comedic scenes when she tries to run away from the police, for example,
But these are comedic scenes that we've seen her do time and time again. It's part of her comic shtick.
Right. And the
problem she's a great physical comedian besides her attitude.
And I think that, Nathan, you probably hit on one of the key issues in Tammy is, you know, what are they trying to make a commentary about weight and the beauty culture? And then if so, how is that playing out when she's surrounded by Susan Sarandon, Allison Janney, Toni Collette, who were reed thin, although at one point Susan Sarandon has these fake swollen ankles to suggest her age or whatever. And I think playing a grandma is fine, and since she's going to be a grandma in the immediate future. But you're right, Nathan, the problem is the fact that there's not a sufficient age differential among all these people. I mean, she could not realistically be Allison Janney's mother, I don't think. Nor can Allison Janney be Melissa McCarthy's mother.
Melissa McCarthy is 43. Allison Janney is 54. And that's 9. Even in Arkansas, that's against the law. And Susan Sarandon is 67. So that's 13 years. That's probably a little more believable in certain parts of the country. All right, but that's, you know, suspension of disbelief. People are going to say, oh, well, you know, you're taking it way too seriously. Okay,
well, so we can get beyond that.
We can get beyond... We've already pointed out this is a bad script. It's a bad concept, and it's just churning out Melissa McCarthy's greatest hits over and over again. What I want to talk about is Falcone as a director, because it's horribly directed. The very first scene where she comes home and finds Toni Collette and her husband not having sex, but having dinner.
Right, a very nice dinner in the dining
room. A beautiful
dinner.
Oh, and it smells so good. You know, the camera is just a simple setup where it goes back and forth, shooting, looking at her, looking at them. There's nothing at all about it beyond directing 101.
Well, there's no energy to this movie. I mean, Tammy doesn't really, even though the characters are, they're trying to get to Niagara Falls for whatever reason. We're not really sure. They just want to go there.
A pleasant memory for Pearl.
Yeah, they just want to go there, I guess. But this movie doesn't have a driving energy. And I think Melissa McCarthy is trying to do something here. I think she's playing to the back rows because there's nothing else for her to do here. So she just kind of amps everything up. And I just have a problem with the way that McCarthy has been treated in a lot of these movies, where the first hour is devoted to her being a buffoon and we laugh at the way she looks. I mean, she's dressed poorly. She's made to look as bad as possible. I mean, this is a deliberate choice on her part, I would imagine, because she's involved in the creative process of this. And we're supposed to laugh at her. And then halfway through, the filmmakers chicken out and turn her into some kind of martyr and make us feel bad for laughing at her because, oh, she's really a good soul, you know, underneath her dumb t-shirts that she's wearing. And I'm tired of that. Either let her be a buffoon or let her be like the character she was in Bridesmaids or The Heat, which was smart and savvy.
Exactly. I mean, particularly Bridesmaids. I wasn't such a big fan of The Heat or Identity Thief.
I wasn't such a fan of The Heat either, but I'm beginning to think I underrated it because Tammy and Identity Thief are both so
okay,
much worse.
Okay, so let's talk about why is this film made $70 million?
I don't know. That's a mystery that I can't quite solve. Melissa McCarthy has a box office draw, obviously, but I don't know. And the trailers are just all of the physical gags. Her trying to run away and getting caught. Her trying to jump over a fast food counter. Her falling down. Her crashing on a jet ski. So obviously that's something
reason, too, is what else has been playing in the theaters? Is there anything else like this out there? No. It's Transformers. It's... whatever else.
Which might explain why we're reviewing it.
yeah, because there was nothing else out there to see. So, Tammy to me seemed like a bad Saturday Night Live skit made into a feature film.
A Saturday Night Live skit that doesn't even have a joke at the center of it. I mean, what's the concept of this movie?
And that was Tammy. This is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. But before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at The Congress and Hellion. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Toothart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed Tammy. Let's now move to The Congress, a weird and twisted critique of the movie business written and directed by Israeli filmmaker Ari Folman. Then Hellion, a film written and directed by Kat Candler and featuring Breaking Bad star Aaron Paul. Let's begin with the bizarre, something called The Congress, which writer-director Folman adapted from a novel by sci-fi writer Stanislav Lem. In 2008, Folman presented the world with an intriguingly made documentary of war, which was based on his own experiences as a member of the Israeli troops that had invaded Lebanon in 1982. Titled Waltz with Bashir, the film uses a stark kind of animation to imbue the poignant, anguished stories that Folman and his fellow soldiers have to tell. The Congress, by contrast, begins as a more or less regular narrative film, except that it has the actress Robin Wright playing an actress named Robin Wright, who is facing a decision. Told that her career is over, she is coerced into signing a contract that allows a movie studio to scan her likeness so that studio execs can manipulate what is a digital clone of her into starring in the kinds of movies she herself has always avoided. Then 20 years later, on the verge of that contract's lapse, Wright visits the studio and, well, again, Folman resorts to portraying everything in animation, this time in a style that is Looney Tunes meets Zap Comics. And when Folman starts directing a world split between truth and fantasy, well, that's when things get really peculiar. What did you think, Mary Pat?
Well, I think a lot of things, and not only about this film, but I found The Congress to be fascinating and frustrating at the same time, because I was tracking with the movie as it goes through its sort of live action portion, talking about, its commentary on modern day Hollywood, its commentary on women in Hollywood in particular, its commentary on how we mesh, technology and use that to its most beneficial effect at the same time, sort of preserving the intellectual property and persona rights, so they might be, of people who are engaged in this industry. And then when it initially segued into the animation portion, I was intrigued by that. But then I kind of lost it. I didn't really understand what its purpose was other than to present these kind of, beautiful, bizarre, and compelling visuals. But the story sort of gets lost in terms of what's the commentary
here.
The story
and the characters, by the way.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. And so I think that its larger statement you know, that this microcosm is used as a larger statement on these, you know, social issues kind of deteriorates when we put it in this other setting.
Well, yeah, the message of the film, I think, just gets completely lost in what Fulman is trying to do here. And I was more on board with the first hour of the Congress, which is almost entirely live action, than I was with the second hour, which is almost entirely animated. And I sympathize with the point that Fulman is trying to make here, which is completely missing from the original novel, which was sort of like a Vonnegut-esque sci-fi satire. And the satirical elements of the story are pretty much missing here, which is that there is ageism present in Hollywood, almost exclusively directed towards the actresses. And the fact that Robin Wright, who right now is probably at the peak of her career, I mean, she's on House of Cards, she's got Emmy nominations, I think she's the heart and soul of that show, and she's being told by these executives that, you know, what she's doing isn't good enough, and if she just stops acting and lets this, you know, digital facsimile of her take over, you know, her career will be better off. She'll look younger, she'll never age on film. I like what he's trying to say there, but he makes his point, and then there's nowhere else to go, really. And you have Harvey Keitel playing her manager, who is given this bizarre, overwritten monologue that clearly looks like he's reading off cue cards, by the way. I don't know what Harvey Keitel was doing in this movie. And then once the animation kicks in, I mean, it's striking. There's definitely sort of a Ralph Bakshi-style anarchy to the animation and the sort of the clashing styles that are going on here, because presumably everyone in this alternate universe can be depicted any way they want, so there are several different styles of drawing going on. And although it was good to look at, it just kind of gets lost in itself.
Right.
As the Robin Wright character sort of descends from one alternate universe to another and then back again, I just got lost. I didn't know what was going on. And so the greater point that Fulman is trying to make in the Congress, I just think gets drowned out by the visuals.
The greater point being, we're assuming this one about ageism and what constitutes a character, what constitutes truth, reality, fiction, fantasy, whatever. He falls into that in the second half. It becomes almost like Snowpiercer in terms of there's these two worlds. You know, there's the real world, and it's all these poor people
least,
who look like they're living in.
But Snowpiercer at least had the sense to be sort of comic, and there was sort of a glee in it, the way that it depicted its world.
I'm not so sure I got the comedy of that. But
I mean, it's a very dark comedy, but this is pretty somber stuff, and it doesn't work.
Yeah, but the point is, it becomes a different movie. And then the second point I wanted to make was the characters get lost. We get introduced to this John Hamm character, who's this animator who's fallen in love with this vision of Robin Wright. And then what about the kids? Cody Smith McKee.
I think that's an important issue, because I do think that there's an underlying theme that never gets adequately developed in terms of, you know, we know that Robin Wright sort of stepped away from Hollywood for a period, the real Robin Wright, to, you know, raise her children. And that's a theme here as well, because we find out that her son sort of inexplicably has some physical issues that are starting to deteriorate. And we sense that maybe that's one of the reasons that she's willing to buy into this scheme to preserve herself, because she knows that, you know, maybe she's going to have to devote this time to her family or whatever. But that's never really developed in a way that would cause some commentary. Now, having said all of this, I do think if people watch this film, there are things to talk about, as we've just demonstrated. And so I would...
If we were talking about thumbs up and thumbs down kinds of film critiquing, I would definitely give this one a thumbs up.
I think my thumb would be
wavering,
sort of hovering in the middle, because I agree with you that there's stuff to talk about here and the visual style is often striking, but I think that he's trying for something that he doesn't achieve, and it's a failure in that way.
Sophomore slump?
Yeah, so what do you do? I mean, I think if you want to see a great animated film, go back and watch Waltz with Bashir, which is a masterpiece of animation.
Absolutely. And that was The Congress. Let's close with a little study of Hard Luck Kids and their grieving dad. Hellion, which was written and directed by independent filmmaker Kat Candler, is a feature-length version of a six-minute short that premiered at the 2012 Sundance Film Festival. Shot in and around Beaumont and Port Arthur, Texas, Candler's film centers on what's left of the Wilson family. Widowed father Hollis, played by Breaking Bad star Aaron Paul, and his two sons Jacob and Wes, played respectively by newcomers Josh Wiggins and Deke Garner. For reasons that only gradually are suggested and never made entirely clear, 13-year-old Josh is the troublemaker of the film's title. As he and his trio of buddies go off on one vandalizing exploit after the next, young brother Wes is slowly drawn into the mix. Dad Hollis, meanwhile, is too bound up in his grief and his drinking to notice what's going on. When Child Protective Services gets involved, Wes is sent to live with his aunt, played by Juliette Lewis, and Josh tries even more desperately to heal wounds that are way beyond any easy fix. Hellion is well-acted and boasts an authentic sense of place, which is good because writer-director Candler tends to put her actors in situations that are at times just a tad overwrought. Think I'm being too hard on Hellion, guys?
No, I don't think so. I agree with you on this. In fact, I actually found Hellion to be a very unpleasant experience, not because of the subject matter, which we've seen before, you know, these poor people living in these, you know, rural Texas or southern towns. I mean, David Gordon Green just had a film earlier this year called Joe, which this movie sort of plays, to me at least, like a pale imitation of that, or last the year before, Mud, which kind of has the same sort of vibe here. This movie hits all of the stops. I mean, it's got that authentic sense of place, as you said, but the story is totally phony. I mean, you've got the dead mother, you've got the alcoholic father, you've got the rebellious kids, and it all predictably explodes into violence at the end, which, to me, the story doesn't naturally arrive at that violent conclusion. It's sort of shoehorned in there because you need something shocking to happen.
And it has all those things, but it doesn't have enough to really explain the essence of what it all means.
And it doesn't have any insight into the characters. These people feel like types, and it's too bad to see Aaron Paul from Breaking Bad, and he does good work here, but his character just feels like your typical alcoholic father trying to recover from the death of his wife, and I don't think any of it really works at all.
Although, I have to say, in Hellion, I did like the portrayal of the aunt by Juliette Lewis, because it was so against type for what we're used to seeing from Juliette Lewis. And there's also this interesting subplot, which I thought was going to be the major focus, about this motocross thing. And I don't really understand. I think it would have been much more interesting and exciting to develop that a little bit more.
It's clearly some kind of metaphor for his inner rebellion, that this is how he sort of lets loose. He rides these dangerous motorbikes, and we're constantly seeing kids spilling off and getting hurt. And there's always a threat of violence in this movie, but once the real violence comes at the end, it doesn't feel earned.
That just skewed everything out of proportion. The two things I did like, even though they did have motocross at the very beginning, this doesn't become a Rocky film. This doesn't become the motocross is going to win everyone together and we're going to have a happy ending. I like that. Really, the only complexity I found in Hellion is the character of the Juliette Lewis, because she's the only one who's doing the right thing by these kids. And yet in the movie,
they see her as a villain, though.
We tend to see her as a villain, too. It's like, what is she doing coming in and interrupting this family? But she is doing the right thing.
And she is
maybe for the wrong reasons, but she...
Well, and I think, I don't know if it is for the wrong reason. I think she has the kid is in her... doing something for the kid's
best
interest.
Aaron Paul addresses at one point, you know, you're Travis left you because you never wanted to have kids, and why do you want to take mine?
And by the way, do you think it's a believable scenario that Child Protective Services would take away one child but not the other? Is that something that...
That does happen sometimes. Okay. I mean, just because
I was questioning that.
Because I think that they're more concerned about the younger child.
But if you've got this aunt character who's clearly well off, lives in a nice house on the other side of town, and both kids are clearly, they have behavioral issues, why wouldn't you put both of them?
Well, and in some circumstances, because of the age of the child, there will be more deference to what the child wants to do. And here,
and also
I think
the aunt didn't want the older one.
Yeah, well, there was always that too.
Sorry, this turned into a legal dissertation at some point.
And speaking of that, I really did like Josh Wiggins. I hope to see him again at
some
point.
He's a good
actor. He plays the 13-year-old boy. But yeah, should have been, could have, would have been better.
I want to see the 6-minute short now, because I hear that's pretty good. And that was Hellion, and this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and early in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed Tammy and the Congress. Before we close, let's take a second to thank Patrick Klausser for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners, and we invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again try to discern cinema treasure from cinema tripe. Until then, remember, another saying by the late, great Kurt Vonnegut. One of the few good things about modern times, if you die horribly on television, you will not have died in vain. You will have entertained us.